Top stories, Lebanon says it has filed a complaint with the UN against Israel for its repeated violations of Lebanese airspace. A NATO official says more than 18,000 people have been evacuated from Kabul airport since the Taliban took over the Afghan capital. And the UN chief urges an immediate ceasefire and unrestricted aid access in Ethiopia's Tigray region, calling humanitarian conditions there hellish. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Lebanon says it has filed a complaint with the UN against Israel for its repeated violations of Lebanese airspace. Caretaker Foreign Minister Zeina Akar said Israeli actions pose a threat to the security and stability of Lebanon. She said the regime is clearly violating international resolutions, especially Resolution 1701. That resolution helped end the 2006 conflict between Israel and Lebanon. Beirut filed a complaint a day after Israel conducted a missile attack on Syria. The Syrian army said the attack was launched from the southeast side of the Lebanese capital and targeted posts near Damascus and Homs. The army said it shot down most of the missiles. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slammed Israel and called it the real source of tension in the region. The Lebanese president says the delay in the formation of a new government is due to politicians' increasing demands from Prime Minister-designate Najib Mirati. Michel Aoun expressed concern that the goal of the demands was to force Mirati to resign, which Aoun said he does not want. On Tuesday, Mirati described forming a government for Lebanon as a difficult arithmetic equation. He made the comment after a meeting with Aoun at the presidential palace. Lebanon's ruling elite have failed to form a new cabinet since Prime Minister Hassan Diab quit following last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port. This has further deepened the country's economic crisis, which the World Bank has described as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. A NATO official says more than 18,000 people have been evacuated from Kabul airport since the Taliban took over Afghanistan's capital on Sunday. The official said the majority of the evacuees are diplomats, foreign nationals, and military personnel. At the same time, people desperate to flee continue to throng outside the airport. That's according to the same NATO official who declined to be named. NATO and U.S. troops have secured Hamid Karzai International Airport and cleared the runway after chaotic scenes at the weekend. 12 people have been killed in and around Kabul airport since Sunday. The Taliban are blocking Afghans without travel documents from entering the airport, but even those with valid papers have struggled to get there, with reports saying some have been beaten by Taliban guards. A confidential UN document says the Taliban, contrary to their claims, are intensifying a search for people who worked with the U.S. and NATO forces. According to the document, the Taliban has priority lists of individuals it wants to arrest. The report says the people most at risk are the ones who had central roles in the Afghan military, police, and intelligence units. It notes that the Taliban have been conducting targeted door-to-door visits of individuals they want to apprehend. Document reported by AFP was written by the Norwegian Center for Global Analyses, an organization that provides intelligence to UN agencies. The Taliban, which came to power last week, pledged full amnesty for all who worked with the former Afghan government. Now, Turkey says it'll act in coordination with the international community in its stance on the recognition of the new government in Afghanistan. Rashan Saglam is in Istanbul.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey, before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Well, in the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan, Iran has seen a steady influx of Afghan refugees. Iran's border police have set up temporary camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to host the inbound refugees. Yusuf Jalali was there and filed this report from the border.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border, and those people over there are Afghan refugees who have just crossed into Iran, a country they call it a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak crossing point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now, with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
U.S. Envoy for Iran Robert Malley says a return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is possible. He says the revival of the deal has been delayed partly because of mistrust sowed during the Trump administration. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that issue with our guests. The U.S. envoy for Iran says a return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is, quote-unquote, in the cards, since both Washington and Tehran have said they want it. Robert Molly said the return has been delayed partly because of mistrust sowed during the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign. He said his country is ready to resume talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but he added Washington is preparing some contingencies if the two sides fail to agree on terms in the coming months. Molly said a wholly separate deal or punitive measures could be among those contingency plans. The U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran and the remaining signatories began talks in April this year to revive the accord. Iran says the U.S. should lift its sanctions verifiably and stop making excessive demands. To discuss this issue a little bit further, I'm going to bring in dear guests from around the world, actually from two places in Europe, to have their views on the matter. Mr. Heinz Gartner, he is a political scientist with International Institute for Peace, who joins us via Skype out of Vienna in Austria. We have Mr. John Bosnich, he's a political analyst who joins us via Skype out of Belgrade. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. Your initial comments, Mr. Gartner, please.
Both sides seem to have lost confidence now that an agreement can be achieved in Vienna, which is unfortunate because in the previous six rounds of talks in Vienna, much has been accomplished already. For example, there is an agreement that about 1,500 sanctions with economic impact will be lifted. And this would be sufficient to give the Iranian economy a big impetus. So the longer the negotiations drag on, the more time Iran will lose to feel the benefits of the sanction relief. Unfortunately, both sides now are stuck in unrealistic requests. For example, the U.S. cannot give Iran guarantees that the next president will not leave an agreement, which I think is unlikely anyway. And on the other hand, the U.S. wants that missiles and regional issues will be included into the talks, which Iran will not accept. These are issues which have to be addressed later. So what I'm saying is return to Vienna as soon as possible, drop the unrealistic requests, and eventually an agreement has to be based on good faith anyway.
Okay. On those unrealistic requests, of course, I'm going to bring in Mr. Bosnich to have his initial comments, as well as, of course, the comments no doubt by Robert Molly that has talked about, the negotiations being in the cards, as well as contingency measures that include punitive measures for a deal that virtually was signed six, 7 years ago with, some totally different terms than what is on the table today, sir.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Indeed, we're talking about unrealistic and unfair requests. In fact, the proper word is to term them demands. America doesn't make requests. They flex their muscles, they threaten to bomb countries, and then they make demands. And because the only thing they ever make are demands, that means that the demands are routinely unrealistic. The purpose is to get other sovereign states to unilaterally agree to limit their own state sovereignty. In other words, to jail their own country from things that other states and other sovereign entities in the world are freely allowed to do simply because they have not agreed to be an American military colony. That's the simple expression of what's happening here. And I'm sure that Iran, like any normal sovereign government would be demanding the right to make sovereign decisions that affect its own people without having a foreign overseer tell them how to run their country. So I would suggest that the best thing that Iran could do now is publicize day by day the demands that America makes so that the world knows verbatim, word by word, what America is demanding of Iran. So other countries like my native Canada will see the similarities in the demands that America makes of Canada about our resources, our water, our oil, and our supplies. And in that way, Iran could start to build a coalition of other sovereign countries around the world who would support its independence and its essential right to protect itself.
Thank you very, very much, both of you gentlemen. Mr. Heinz Gardner, political scientist with the International Institute for Peace, as well as Mr. John Bosnich, political analyst in Belgrade. Thank you very much for your time. The UN chief has called humanitarian conditions in Ethiopia hellish as a conflict in the northern region of Tigray drags on and spreads to other parts of the country. Antonio Guterres urged an immediate ceasefire and unrestricted aid access in Tigray, where millions need help. He said it's time for all parties to recognize that there is no military solution. Guterres added, preserving the unity and stability of Ethiopia is critical to the region and beyond. Ethiopian government troops and forces loyal to Tigray's leaders have been in war for the control of the region since November of last year. Thousands have already been killed and many more displaced. The conflict has escalated in recent weeks as it spread to two neighboring regions of Afar and Amhara.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Peaceful march of the masses and a lot of youngsters joining in the beat. Actually, it is to mourn a grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, that is Imam Hussein, third leader of the Shias.
Some things never get old, say sorrow and inspiration, the struggle for basic rights and dignity, and aspiring to betterment. Each year, this country is shrouded in black to mourn Imam Hussein and companions, and to honor the epic battle of Karbala. What the event inspires today and how Corona will allow a commemoration we'll be pointing to in this episode. So stay with me, Leila Faramaizi, on Iran Today.
After cruel Umayyad rule, the children of the fourth caliph, Ali the Infallible, ought to have taken the reins of Islamic rule. Among them, Hussein. But on their way to the seat of the caliphate in the year 680 AD, or 61 Hijra, Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were faced by what's known as the army of Yazid I, The resistance that ensued came to be known as an uprising. Mr. Tavakoli is a writer, researcher, and West Asia expert teaching at university. We got to meet him at his office in the Art Center.
Resistance is in fact a ramification of Ashura. When you come to realize with regard to the Muslim world that the enemies of Islam, enemies of people, enemies of this geographical zone have mobilized their forces for maximum dominance, be it cultural, economic, or geopolitical, upon regional nations, the common political logic, be it liberalism or nationalism, failed to find an answer. Even the most leading anti-hegemony movement, for example Marxism, which itself grew into a new force of dominance, failed to overpower capitalism and imperialism.
Imam Hussein was beheaded, as were his 72 companions, killed or taken as captive. Among those killed was Hussein's six-month-old baby boy. This bears the question whether the resistance was pre-planned or consequential. But it happened. The blood of pure souls was shed. And under a millennium and a half later, in spite of a surge with COVID-19, mourning tents, yards, and congregation halls named Husseinias were set up as Muharram set in. Mr. Harizavi, a cleric of rank, is deputy for Islamic promotion. He received us at his relevant office, a pleasant space with welcoming people.
This year, in my opinion, the observation of protocols will be between 85% to 90%, although the enemies try to show it otherwise. In other words, there might be violations in 5 gatherings out of the 105,000 gatherings across the country, but the enemies portray the 5 instances in cyberspace as if they were happening in half of all the gatherings and call for all the gatherings to be banned. This is unfair. God willing, people will be careful. We have good people. They won't allow their devotion to Imam Hussein to lead to a further spread of the disease, so the enemies can take advantage.
Why do Shias hold the Tasua Ashura ceremony each year? What current events over time have kept the flame alive?
One instance is the martyrdom of Haj Qasem Soleimani, which created a huge movement in Iran and the countries in the region, as a great commander like Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was martyred alongside him. The two great figures fought against the enemies together. Remember, after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, people from all walks of life, tendencies, appearances, even those who didn't adhere to religious laws, came out to protest. It's exactly what we're witnessing in Lebanon, where many of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's followers are Christians who practice their own religion, but their political thought follows the idea of resistance.
In Iraq's holy city of Karbala alone, where Imam Hussein has been laid to rest, over 20 million Shia Muslims gather annually to pay homage. Those who can't make it commemorate the triumph of blood over the sword elsewhere over the 10-day mourning period, ending in Tasua and Ashura, the 9th and 10th days, and on Arba'in, the Imam's 40th day or 40-day martyrdom anniversary. The nation, among 200 million Shias worldwide, are black-clad at large on the 10 days and on Arba'in, the 40th commemorative day that falls into the following month of Safar. Muharram is among months labeled the Haram or Forbidden months, when war is prohibited. In other words, Husseini resistance is meant to be peaceful. Interestingly, the Islamic resistance appears to have been more successful, perhaps even the only successful movement against the US and Israel, apparently because of its peaceful nature. Mr. Jalali, a cleric of considerable rank, gave us some of his time as well as access to a yard he has downtown where his following congregate for religious ceremonies. This year, it's been decorated no less abundantly than any time before, with motifs bringing to life the event of Ashura.
Imam Hussein's conduct in the face of enemy troops carries a social lesson. When the enemy troops were approaching, Imam Hussein did not cease to worry about their concerns, including physical health, like possible thirst. Therefore, Imam Hussein immediately ordered commanders and water distributors to supply waters to enemy troops. When we see such conducts, we can't remain indifferent towards fellow humans.
Congregations of believers are not easy to stop, and not everyone in the system cared to completely scrap the ceremony. It is a way of enlivening religious belief among youngsters, as the most popular cantors trigger their energy and thoughts. And with an economy in trouble, the nation can do with a little normalcy. Over the past 4 decades, Iranians have endured all sorts of hardship imposed by foreign powers and have demonstrated where they felt wronged by domestic authorities, but to both class as resistance.
The fact is that the end point of the uprising is to fight the external enemy. But if you have noticed, there was some sort of influence in the government itself. As the Umayyads infiltrated the Islamic government, or the Jews somehow came and made plans, we must also rise up here against the oppression around us. As Imam Hussein himself said, his uprising was one within the Muslim Ummah. Well, the unfair developments in Khuzestan, the shortcomings which were due to some misguided measures taken there, the developments in Haftape or Sistan and Balochistan, all these can be approached with the spirit of demand and protest that Imam Hussein has placed in our conscience.
The outer world also closely observes the marches and mourners of Muharram and Arba'in. It's a long tale, and we've plenty more to say on it. But first, a quick media review with Sarah.
Hello and welcome to a new edition with me, Sarah Adema. As we are getting closer to Ashura, today we're going to review some lessons from different media outlets. And the first one begins with Tehran Times that says, Ashura is an integral part of Iranian identity. Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, said back in the revolution days that the victory of the Islamic Revolution was because of Imam Hussein's uprising. He stated, "We all should understand that if it had not been for the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we would not have won. The Islamic Revolution of Iran is a reflection of Ashura and its great divine revolution." He also said that the mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein alayhi salam played a major role in unifying the Iranian people against the Shah. In Imam Khomeini's view, the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who is also known as the Master of Martyrs, is the main reason that preserved the Muslim countries. The later leader said, "We have to see what the secret of the survival of this religion and the survival of Muslim and Shiite countries is, and we should protect that secret. The biggest secret in this regard is the issue of the Master of Martyrs." Under Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Iran continued to follow the Imam Hussein's footsteps. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated in Ahl al-Bayt news agency, "Psychological warfare aims at fueling Lebanon's crises." Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that the crisis in Lebanon is being deliberately exacerbated. He pointed to recent developments surrounding fuel supplies that turned into a fabricated crisis, which people corresponded with, making the situation worse. During his speech at the Central Ashura commemorations, he gave several instructions to the supporters of the resistance, stressing the importance of honesty in reporting facts and not slandering or accusing anyone without evidence, and not to curse or insult anyone. He said, "Differences in opinion do not mean attacking others. Criticizing is one thing, and attacking them is another. Whoever among the clergymen or male and female media professionals talk about politics, we have the right to respond to them, but within certain norms, and not to attack them personally." He explained further, "Insulting and belittling is a sign of weakness, while the strong discusses and puts forward ideas and does not need to insult others." Our final lesson reads in Daily Times, "Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the quintessential custodian of Islam. The painful tragedy of Karbala reminds us not to bow down before a despot and tyrant ruler, and never flinch from raising our voice against injustice, oppression, and despotism. This is what Imam Hussein alayhi salam did at the hottest and the arid plains of Karbala." To cap it all, I would quote Allama Iqbal, who paid glowing tribute to Imam Hussein in his book, The Secrets of Selflessness. He says in his book, he, meaning Hussein, annihilated despotism till the day of resurrection. The sugar of his blood brought forth the garden of liberty. For truth, he ruled in dust and blood, and thus he had fortified the foundation of Islam. The secret of Quran we have learned from Imam Hussein's example. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, also eulogized Imam Hussein in following words. The world is unable to present an example finer and brighter than the personality of Imam Hussein, inasmuch as he was the embodiment of love and valor and personification of sacrifice and devotion. Every Muslim should learn a lesson from his life and should receive guidance from him. And that's it for me in today's edition. And now, back to you, Leila.
We mentioned how Ashura was a mobilizing force to the axis of resistance, in turn mobilizing the region against the US and Israel, and now loose jihadism and Wahhabi and Takfiri sects. You recall General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the US just after New Year. He was instrumental in defeating Daesh or ISIS in Syria and Iraq by moving forces he likened to Imam Hussein and his small army of friends and family. In fact, he referred to Iranians as the nation of Hussein and expected them to plant the seeds of sacrifice and resisting oppressors everywhere. I asked what similarities could be found between the Islamic resistance of today and the event of Ashura.
When the Salafi and Wahhabi thought came together in the Sunni political Islam, especially its Takfiri spectrum, we witnessed the emergence of anti-religious phenomena in the Islamic world, meaning that one sect of Islam started to fight against the other faiths and sects. The Salafi Takfiris distorted the definition of the immediate and distant enemies, changing the immediate enemy from political leaders who are obedient to the West to the Shias, saying that although the distant enemies are the US and Israel, we must first go after the Shias and other faiths that don't agree with us. That's when they started to fight faiths and tried to subjugate their followers, commit massacres, behead people, the exact approach taken by the Umayyads. Therefore, all those who followed the thought of Ashura and the ideas of Imam Hussein came forward. Their beliefs have been so strong that make them give up life and enter this field. Therefore, the axis of resistance has a meaningful connection, and perhaps the deepest philosophical and fundamental connection with the uprising of Imam Hussein.
Since there's been plenty of mention of Daesh and resisting it, as well as US and Israel or US allies, well, Daesh was a monstrous terror group, and among groups created or backed by the US when the time was right. They're a means of using religion against religion, or getting religion to shoot itself in the foot. This has been evident in the actions of Daesh against fellow Muslims even. How does that promote the image or following of Islam? Daesh, which was, and the MEK or Iran's Mujahideen, known as the Hypocrites, and the Al-Saud dynasty, are all aligned against the Islamic resistance. The enemy is equipped with every dark force, and Iran cannot stop its regional policy. In fact, it calls the war on terror a holy war, while differentiating between martyrdom and suicidal acts of terror. The history of Islam is 1,400 years old and more. Now, there's discrepancies to be seen even in political accounts of the day. But all sects agree on the ill done the descendants of the Prophet and the suffering of Imam Hussein and companions. How we apply the lesson to the world of today, though, matters much. I went down to Parliament to hear how from a Miss Lajavardi, an MP on the Cultural Committee.
If only we can picture and retell those stories, they have so many beautiful truths that we can learn a whole life lesson from. A lesson of endurance, self-sacrifice, and devotion. how to come out victorious in the face of difficulties. We can pass them on, but unfortunately not enough work has been done to recount the story artistically. Each and every person in the story can be characterized. For example, Zuhai, who wasn't involved in the issues at all but 10 near that of Imam Hussein. How he got involved or what was his wife's role in his redemption and martyrdom, these all have stories that we can learn life lessons from.
Iran's method is the resistance against foreign forces in the region and their strongholds, especially the ones slowly wiping the holy shrines and Palestine off the map, Israel. Today, resistance on another front is also of paramount importance. That is with the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, which began in April. They're in limbo, as Western parties to the deal, especially the US, are drawing talks out to get Iran to finally buckle down under the pressure of U.S. sanctions. They think Iran may sign a JCPOA 2 or JCPOA plus this way, but Iran hasn't backed down an inch and is not likely to do so with the Ashura anniversary serving as a reminder to resistance, just weeks before the seventh round of Vienna talks.
There are many free thinkers in the world like Gandhi, who had no religious affiliation with Islam, but sanctified Imam Hussein and honored him as their leader. This is true in Muslim countries, both among Shiites and Sunnis. Imam Hussein is influential and inspiring as a descendant of Prophet Muhammad and a great martyr. This has been the case for years, and we believe it will continue to be so in the future and will make more important impacts in human civilization.
Iran's support for Palestinian groups has been a key feature in spearheading pro-resistance and pan-Islamic solidarity. Groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Secular Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Iran's support for and by the Axis stems from its revolutionary ideology of wanting to be a cause, not just a country. For and since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran's leaders have legitimized acts of resistance and uprising, if recognized to be anti-oppression. Well, the eight-year war of the 80s waged on Iran by Iraq is an unquestionable example. In drawing on the Ashura narrative of the victims voiceless but standing, perhaps hoping for time to set the record straight, this country interestingly did this. When Iran accepted the UN Resolution 598 for the ceasefire with Iraq, its substantial demand was not war reparations, but to be recognized as the victim of invasion, and that it finally achieved.
After a nation rises up, if it persists and values its uprising and believes in it, the uprising turns to resistance. If the resistance continues, it will change to endurance and become long-lasting. In our opinion, the Iranian people's uprising turned into resistance, then took the form of endurance, and now has been internalized to the point where they exercise perseverance in the face of all the hardships and sanctions and choose their uprising over giving up. Between resistance and surrender, they choose the former.
It was the Islamic faith that drove our youngsters during the eight-year war. If there were another war to break out now, what do you think would drive them?
As a historian who has authored The Biology of Many Martyrs and has been at the war front, I would say that those who were today fighting Daesh have done much more sacrifice than what we did. Those who are fighting Daesh in Syria have much stronger faith than our generation. We really envy them and we feel that we are distant from them.
Another example is resistance against Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And in case you're wondering how it all started, revolutionary Shiism emerged in the 1960s in response to global anti-colonial movements. It centered on resistance against oppression with a look to Shia fighters and martyrdom and by drawing on the Karbala metaphor. To Iran as a state, the tale is more than a script for passion plays or even history books. The post-revolution constitution commands support for the oppressed and Muslims of the world, and it's claimed to have been inspired by the ordeal of Imam Hussein and companions.
How bravely Imam Hussein might have fought would not matter if his only intention were to score a battlefield win, because he was surrounded by an army attacking on all sides with spears, swords, and arrows, and eventually Shim ruthlessly beheaded him, thirsty and heavily wounded. But not to fear, because words carry far and long, and that's all a legacy needs, to be related and learned from. And this is where Zainab, peace be upon her, comes in.
After Imam Hussein and his companions are martyred in the scene of Ashura, their enemies take Hazrat Zainab as a captive and chain her, taking the captives from city to city in the worst possible way until they reach the Levant. They cheer to humiliate the family of Imam Hussein, but the exact opposite of what they wanted happened, because Hazrat Zainab was an orator so skillful that people said it was as if Imam Ali was speaking when he delivered a speech. While giving a speech in Yazid's court, she commanded everyone to silence, and all the participants in the majestic court of Yazid immediately became silent to listen to her sermons. Her speech made Yazid's family, who was sitting behind a veil, cry and oppose him. Her sermons were so powerful that his rule didn't last long after.
The merging of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance movement with the ideals of the Ashura Uprising can be seen in Chapter 10 on Foreign Policy, Article 152. That bases the country's foreign policy on the rejection of any kind of domination, the preservation of all-inclusive independence of the country, the defense of the rights of all Muslims, and non-alignment in relation to domineering powers.
Iran's Islamic Revolution was a phenomenon that was 15 years in the making from the year 1964 and gradually became complete. During the course of time, the leadership found its meaning and the Imam found its true place. That was made possible by Muslims with lofty aspirations and motives.
The Islamic Revolution started from religious morning gatherings. These gatherings have been special as they recount the truths about Ashura and underline the importance of fighting against evil, although with a few fighters. This is significant as people are shown how to follow the truth in the way Imam Hussein and his companions did.
We said the Islamic resistance had been successful. Since 1979, revolutionary Shiism has linked Tehran with a network of Shia groups in the region. These include Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Hashda Shabi in Iraq, and the Houthis in Yemen. And it's not just a matter of fighting power, but winning the hearts and minds of regional brethren.
Basically, any uprising that arises to fight against oppression becomes permanent, and truth-seeking and righteous people will follow it. The uprising of Ashura is a complete tragedy due to its unique historical characteristics. It's an event in which women and children were involved from its creation until it ended in conveying the message of resistance and perseverance.
That would be the end of our account of the day. Thanks from the whole team. But we've an account a week, so do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Till then, bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram. Times of sadness have.
As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue, a special program for the month of Muharram.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima bint Muhammad. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards beauty and perfection. The one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura saying, in so many difficulties and sorrows, in which friends desert the person and enemies unleash their cruel tongues, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. The words of Imam al-Hussein while entering Mecca.
قَالَ الْإِمَامُ الْحُسَيْنَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامُ ولما توجه تلقاء مدين قال عسى ربي أن يهديني سواء السبيل.
And as he turned his face towards Midian, he said to himself, it may well be that my sustainer will thus guide me unto the right path.
السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات. السلام عليك يا السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات. السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات. أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب. السلام على الخد التريب.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين.
Sallallahu alayk, ya Abu Abdullah. It must be indicated that in the discourses of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and all the infallibles, we find in many places that instead of reasoning, instead of mentioning a reason in their own language, the infallibles, I mean starting from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and moving up to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, we find that they mention and they quote an appropriate Quranic verse. Here in this context, here in this situation, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam recited a verse of the Holy Quran taken from Surah Al-Qisas, verse 22. When we study this Quranic verse, we find that it's about the time when the Prophet Moses went to the city Madian. And the Prophet Moses left the city to the city of Madian because he wanted to escape from the hands of the tyrants, the agents of Pharaoh, and went to Madian. And at the same time, the Prophet Moses, as indicated in the Holy Quran, expressed his wish to be directed to the right path. Being directed to the right path doesn't necessarily mean being victorious, in the sense of any military triumph or military victory, rather in the sense of achieving one's aims and high goals. Now we find that the reason to indicate it can be explained thus. First of all, this Quranic verse can be regarded as an appropriate expression by which the situation of Imam al-Husayn al-Islam can be described, and that Imam al-Husayn al-Islam indicated it, and by repeating this Quranic verse, intended to say that, like the situation of Moses who opposed the Pharaoh, Imam al-Husayn al-Islam intended to oppose the tyrant of the time, who was none but Yazid ibn Muawiyah. And as the Pharaoh was an abominable person to be a tyrant, Yazid was in the same situation. At the same time, we find that Imam al-Husayn al-Islam intended to indicate that his line and his decision wasn't certainly something personal or individual, rather the movement of Imam al-Husayn al-Islam was in the same line of the movement of arch-prophets. And this is a very important point to note, that Imam al-Husayn al-Islam followed not only the line and decisions of ordinary politicians, rather he followed the right of great prophets. As-salamu alayk, ya Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
Grateful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.